leader!
Order, order.
The House resumed on Tuesday after a fortnight's adjournment, with John Key's National-led minority government having finally signed the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement and able to report its first operating surplus since taking over the Treasury benches 7 years ago. Triumphant government ministers keen to extract maximum political capital out of the good news, sceptical opposition parties equally as eager to deny them the satisfaction. While the front benches took up slings and arrows in the debating chamber, the committee room saw the Health Committee start its inquiry into public attitudes towards euthanasia, while the Government Administration Committee began hearing submissions on the members' bill from Labour's Sue Moroney extending paid parental leave to 26 weeks. With a complicated history, this bill was sent to the committee after passing its first reading last month by the slimmest of margins, 61-60, supported by all parties except National and ACT, while the three votes of the other two government allies, the Maori Party and United Futures' Peter Dunn, gave the bill its winning margin. That same scenario, with the Maori Party and the MP for the Wellington seat of Ohariu joining all other parties to defeat National and ACT, occurred again on Wednesday night, pushing two more Labour Party members' bills through to the committee rooms, while two other bills failed, one lacking support from Peter Dunn, but not the Maori Party, going down by 62-59, and the other failing by 61-60, after Mr Dunn crossed back to join National and ACT's member for Epsom, David Seymour, who consistently voted with National. The four vacancies that created on the members' order paper were filled the next day by bills drawn from the 75 in the ballot. Three of them were from Labour MPs and one, like Sue Moroney's parental leave bill, was on its second time around, after also being stalled by a 60-60 dead heat vote earlier this year, when National was one down after the resignation of its Northland MP, Mike Sabin. His seat was then taken in a by-election won by New Zealand First Leader Winston Peters, and that critical vote moved back across the chamber to restore the opposition's potential for a majority of 61 that they had in the last parliament. Originally in the name of Labour's housing spokesman Phil Twyford, the Healthy Homes Guarantee Bill, aimed at ensuring that every rental home meets the minimum standards of heating and insulation, went back in the ballot under the name of the Labour Party leader Andrew Little. It became one of the lucky four drawn on Thursday. But unlike Sue Moroney's bill, the changes that had been made to it were not judged to be sufficient to get around the rule barring bills that are substantially the same as bills that have already been defeated in the same calendar year. It was referred to the Speaker, David Carter, who delivered his judgment on it before question time on Thursday.
In my opinion, this bill should never have been accepted for the ballot. I have asked the clerk to ensure that bills proposed to go on the ballot are scrutinised more carefully for compliance with Standing Order 264. In future, bills that are the same in substance as ones read or defeated in the same calendar year will not be permitted into the ballot.
Saying that Mr Carter's ruling was without precedent, Labour's Chief Whip Chris Hipkins argued that the bill should have been challenged in the 4 months before it was drawn from the ballot, and that it had only been entered after advice had been sought from the clerk's office.
And was assured that in fact this bill met standing orders. Members of this House must be able to have confidence that the advice they receive from the clerk's office is in fact accurate. I therefore ask, Mr Speaker, that you withdraw the ruling pending further consideration of the matter by either the Standing Orders Committee or the Business Committee.
But Mr Carter said he'd already given it considerable thought.
The member's very first point is right. This is the first time that this has ever happened. But I made the point that in my mind this bill should never have been accepted. If advice was given that it was acceptable, I don't accept that that advice was right. Mistakes do happen. I therefore needed to chart a way forward subsequent to the bill being drawn out of the ballot, and I think I have very fairly found a mechanism for that to move forward.
And that is, if the bill comes up for its first reading on one of the 3 members' days remaining in 2015, it will be ruled out of order. Otherwise, it will be in a new calendar year and therefore free to proceed.
I expect far more scrutiny to take place from the clerk and his staff before bills are accepted into the ballot in the first place. I think we are creating history here. I hope we don't have an opportunity to see it repeated, but I think I've given a very fair way forward for this particular case, and I don't intend to review the decision at all.
And those weren't the only stern words from the Speaker this week. Mr Carter also tore a strip off the Minister of Health after Jonathan Coleman defied him by repeating a claim that his Labour shadow, Annette King, was making things up.
I'm very tempted to be asking the Minister to leave this chamber. It's becoming a bit of a habit of this Minister to continue to create disorder in this House. On this occasion, he can stay, but if it happens again, my patience will not last very long with this particular Minister, and that is the last warning I will be giving the Honourable Dr Jonathan Coleman.
The Minister had been quizzed by Mrs King on the impact of the TPPA on the health budget, one of many questions from a sceptical opposition that drew scorn from National's Melissa Lee.
Shame on the opposition for opposing, what it seems like it's an opposition to free trade agreements. And I'm believing that they will probably come to party and say yes and celebrate the TPP as well.
But Labour's David Parker said the opposition were only doing their job.
There have been some intemperate comments coming from the National Party in the last week. They've tried to criticise Annette King and the Labour Party for asking questions that the opposition parties ought to be asking, which is, what is the underlying effect on things like Pharmac?
David Parker was speaking in Wednesday's general debate, which opened with this from Finance Minister Bill English.
Well, Mr Speaker, it's been a great week for New Zealand and a terrible week for the Labour Party, because New Zealand got the TPP and a surplus, and the Labour Party got the best advice Grant Robertson could give them.
Labour's finance spokesman, Grant Robertson, meanwhile tried to rub some of the gloss off the Minister's first operating surplus with questions like this one from Mr English on Wednesday.
When John Key was giving him a high five for achieving a $414 million surplus, did he tell him that it wouldn't have happened if he hadn't cut $444 million from the projection for Canterbury EQC payouts?
The Honourable Bill English.
Mr Speaker, no, because the member's just wrong. I mean, he can go on an Easter egg hunt where he finds every accounting adjustment that exists that's around $400 million, but it'll just make him look like a little bunny.
Supplementary question, Mr Speaker.
Order. Grant Robertson.
Does he think the people of Canterbury will be wanting to give him a high five when they hear that he got his surplus by cutting money from their already inadequate budget for EQC earthquake repairs?
The Honourable Bill English.
Mr Speaker, I think they'd probably intuitively grasp the way the government finances work a bit better than the member. And actually, people all over Christchurch high-five the Minister for Earthquakes because he's overseen the repair of 400,000 insurance claims, the rebuilding of thousands of new homes, the planning and the revival of the Central Business District. And many people in Christchurch are pretty pleased with the government's $15 billion contribution to the rebuilding of their city.
Finance Minister Bill English. Now from the Chamber to the committee rooms, where Rhys Lyon reports on the first day of the Health Committee's inquiry into euthanasia.
The Health Committee's inquiry into public attitudes towards medically assisted dying or euthanasia began on Wednesday when former Labour MP Marion Street, whose petition on euthanasia sparked off the inquiry, appeared before the committee and explained why it was needed.
I spent 3 years as a Member of Parliament going around the country talking to people about this issue. And it seems to me that the nervousness that MPs generally seem to hold with respect to debating this issue, declaring themselves on this issue, promoting legislation on this issue, comes from a lack of awareness of how very popular it is, how very much needed it is.
Ms Street sought to explain the reasons for those seeking end-of-life choice.
They wish that having been self-determining, autonomous adults in their lifetime, they would like to be self-determining, autonomous adults at their end time. And that is as simple as it gets.
Former Labour MP Marion Street presenting that evidence to the Health Committee's inquiry into euthanasia, and submissions on that inquiry are open until February 1st next year. Elsewhere on Wednesday, Labour's Sue Moroney presented her bill calling for an extension to paid parental leave from 18 to 26 weeks. Ms Moroney said the bill was similar to a previous bill in her name, which failed to pass its final reading earlier this year, though this one introduced provisions around work contact hours.
The idea with work contact hours is that parents who are on paid parental leave can come back and do a small and limited amount of paid work that, in my mind, is likely to be training opportunities that they will be paid to undertake during the course of that 6 months and not lose their entitlement to 6 months paid parental leave.
And Ms Moroney pointed to support for her bill from one particular member of the public gallery.
This baby who I've just met is 5.5 months old. We have a 5.5 month old baby in the room with us. And you can see the level of interaction that's happening right before your eyes. And this interaction is starting to make a real difference between the period of paid leave that we have in place now, which is heading towards 18 weeks, and the 26 weeks period.
Labour's Sue Moroney presenting her Parental Leave and Employment Protection 6 months Paid Leave and Work Contact Hours Amendment Bill to the Government Administration Committee. And submissions on that bill are open until November the 6th. Also this week, on Thursday, public law specialist Mei Chen was up before the Justice and Electoral Committee to make a submission on its inquiry into last year's election and outlined research she'd done into low voter turnout among new migrants to New Zealand.
New fresh migrants take 4 elections to vote. Yeah. And the reason is because in the first election, they don't know what's going on. They just know that there's a thing called a general election and everyone's rushing around. So by the time they learn English, particularly if they come from a really different culture, get a job, sort their kids out, learn to buy food. You know, I mean, it takes a while.
And Mei Chen suggested another cause of voter apathy amongst some migrants.
The fact that they also come from source countries where government's not really serious, it's not really a free election, has an impact on them. It's because when you say to a person like that, your vote counts, they say, well, why does it? It's never counted back home. And then, of course, you've got the problems of no habit of voting. And so with many of these people, you're starting from scratch to develop the habit of voting. You can see that new migrants, particularly if they come from very different cultures where they don't speak the language, really are struggling.
Ms Chen suggested a way to improve voter turnout among migrants.
To make sure they're educated about the history and the culture, about the importance of the treaty, about the Indigenous peoples, about how our system of government works. A lot of the time I'm spending time with migrants saying, look, you need to get involved. Why aren't you getting involved in central local government? Why aren't you having their say? And they say, well, we don't speak very good English. We have no understanding of the system. We don't think it makes any difference. So we just focused on our own rice bowl. Well, that's not good for New Zealand.
Public law specialist Mei Chen with that submission to the Justice and Electoral Committee's inquiry into the 2014 election. All up, there were 15 committee meetings held during the week. Also this week, the Environment Canterbury Transitional Governance Arrangements Bill, which would establish a mixed model governance structure for the Canterbury Regional Council, passed its first reading in the House and was sent off to the Local Government and Environment Committee. The only government support party to vote against that bill was Peter Dunn's United Future, though Mr Dunn himself, as Internal Affairs Minister, saw 2 bills in his name pass their final readings on Thursday afternoon. The first was a bill that, as Mr Dunn explained, would extend the validity period for New Zealand passports from 5 to 10 years.
That longer validity period will benefit adult New Zealand travellers who will need to renew their passports less often. And also, the fee for 1 10-year passport will be substantially less than the fee for 2 5-year passports. Now, this change alone has made the Passports Amendment Bill No. 2 a very popular bill.
And that was evident when the bill later passed its final reading unopposed. Next up was the final reading of a bill that updates laws regarding pokie machines, a debate also kicked off by Mr Dunn.
The background to this bill is actually the member's bill that was sponsored by the Honourable Tuara Flavel, which became the Gambling Harm Reduction Amendment Act 2013. The Flavel bill, as it was colloquially known, attracted a very large number of submitters that raised a wide range of issues with the current framework for gambling operations in pubs and clubs. Views were expressed that parts of the framework for controlling this type of gambling were not perceived to be working particularly well. So this bill responds to some of those concerns and also simplifies some aspects of regulating the sector.
And the Gambling Amendment Bill No. 3 later passed its final reading by 93 votes to 28, supported by National, Labour, ACT and United Future, but opposed by the Greens, Māori Party and New Zealand First. That was followed by the third reading of a bill that updates standards and accreditation laws, that bill passing with minutes to spare before the House adjourned for the week, supported by National, ACT and United Future, but opposed by all other parties.
That report from Rhys Lyon. The Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement drew a constant flow of questions from both sides of the House during the week. We'll start off with this one for the Minister of Economic Development, Stephen Joyce, from the New Zealand First Party's trade spokesman, Fletcher Tabateau.
How would the Trans-Pacific Partnership help regional New Zealand?
The Honourable Stephen Joyce.
Well, Mr Speaker, thank the member for his question. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is exciting news for businesses across New Zealand, but particularly for those in regional New Zealand. The Trans-Pacific Partnership allows New Zealand exporters access to up to 800 million potential customers and covers 40% of existing global trade. In the US, the world's largest economy, in Japan, the world's third largest economy, and across the rapidly developing Asia-Pacific region, TPP will benefit all our exporters by opening up fairer access to more markets, whether they are farmers in Hawke's Bay or the Manawatu, wine growers in Central Otago or manufacturers in the Waikato. As a government, we back our farmers, our horticulturists, our wine growers and our manufacturers. We're confident they're equal to the best in the world, and with this agreement they get access to big consumer markets to compete on a more equal footing with local suppliers. And this is exactly the same answer to the same question yesterday, Mr Speaker.
Supplementary question, Fletcher Tabateau.
Thank you, sir. What happens to the New Zealand regional economy if TPP signatories fail to complete necessary domestic procedures within 2 years after the initial signing?
The Honourable Stephen
Joyce. Well, Mr Speaker, if individual countries don't accede to the agreement, then obviously they won't be participating in it, which would be the effect of the status quo as it is now. But I strongly believe that those countries will accede to the agreement because of the obvious benefits that agreement brings.
Point of order. Yes, point of order.
Point of order, Fletcher Tabateau.
Thank you, sir. I seek leave to table an article dated the 13th of October.
Source of the article, please.
A subscription-only trade journal, so it is not widely accessible, outlining this process, sir, contrary.
I'll accept the member's word. Leave us all to table this particular article. Is there any objection? There is objection. Further supplementary?
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Fletcher Tabateau.
Thank you, sir. What happens to the deal, given Mr Gross had told Q&A, everyone should wait until the officials from 12 countries can do this Herculean task of getting the text into
order,
its final
shape? Order. I need a supplementary question, not a chance to make a speech. Can the member rephrase the question in
so
line with standing orders?
If he agrees with this statement, what would be the conclusion if the Spanish or French versions of this agreement contest the English version?
The Honourable Stephen Joyce.
Well, Mr Speaker, actually there's quite a tradition of actually translation that occurs between languages as a general rule. So, for example, when I say bonjour to you now, I mean hello, and hola would be Spanish. And, you know, there is legions of people, Mr Speaker, whose job it is to translate.
Order. Order.
Despite the confusion it was.
Order. 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 Now, is the member going to attempt to raise a point of order?
Yes, that was my point, sir.
Then I will hear the point of order, but I expect to hear it in silence.
I just wanted an answer to the question.
Order. The difficulty is, I suspect I didn't understand the question because it was such a long-winded question. If the member could take some time out to practice asking supplementary questions. Order! I don't want comment from the back half of the, on my right-hand side. I go back through the questions yesterday particularly. They are too long-winded. The member would do himself a favour if he could sharpen up his supplementary questions so I can assist him to then get an answer that's satisfactory. Point of order. Any order. Any member has a right to raise a point of order. But I just want to be fair to the member. If he's in any way attempting to relitigate where I've just been with a ruling, I will be most upset.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
One mark, point of order.
In trying to assist my colleague, sir, and asking for your indulgence, his question started with the word what. He went on to quote word for word what a minister had said.
The member's relitigating just where we've been. If the member wants to have a look at standing orders, it describes quite clearly the questions are meant to be concise. It doesn't require the length of quote the member was putting into his question. I can assist the member get answers to his question when they are simple and concise, but the way it was worded is unsatisfactory and is not in line with standing orders. The fact that it starts with the word what doesn't suddenly make it correct. Now, if the member has further supplementaries, then we can move on. I hope they are going to be in line with standing orders.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker.
Fletcher Tabatone.
Supplementary question. When these guys are ready. Supplementary. Regional New Zealand needs to know what will the Japanese tariff on beef under the TPPA be if beef imports into Japan from TPP countries exceed 550,000 tonnes during the first year of implementation.
The Honourable Stephen Joyce.
Speaker, those details will all come through in the finalised text, but I can tell the member that over time, the beef tariffs for New Zealand into Japan drop from 38.5% to I think around 9.5%, which by anybody's measure is a great step forward for beef farmers into Japan.
Back across the chamber, another question about the TPPA, this time from a government backbencher, Nationals MP for Taranaki King Country, Barbara Kuriga.
My question's to the Minister for Primary Industries and asks, what reports has he received on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, on how the Trans-Pacific Partnership will benefit the New Zealand dairy industry?
The Honourable Nathan Guy.
Speaker, dairy will have the biggest tariff savings of any sector from the TPP. When fully implemented, the potential savings will be around $102 million per year, roughly 40% of the overall gains. New Zealand's dairy exporters will have preferential access to new quotas in the United States, Japan, Canada, and Mexico, in addition to tariff elimination on a number of products. While we are disappointed there wasn't agreement to eliminate all dairy tariffs, the TPP still gives us better access than what we have now.
Mitri, Mr. Speaker.
Supplementary question, Barbara Kerrigan.
To the Minister, apart from tariff reductions, what other benefits will the TPP deliver to the dairy industry?
The Honourable Nathan
Speaker, Dyer. Good question. Importantly, the TPP also reduces non-tariff barriers to trade and ensures fair access for New Zealand exporters in TPP countries. It will give our exporters more certainty at the border, with customs, food safety and biosecurity rules more transparent across the 11 countries. This means fewer delays for goods to clear at the border, more reliability of supply and less compliance costs for our exporters.
The Minister for Primary Industries, Nathan Guy, whose Cabinet colleague Nick Smith had to answer a related question about agriculture, had to step in for Workplace Relations Minister Michael Woodhouse to answer a related question about agriculture from Labour's Palmerston North MP Ian Lees-Galloway.
My question is to the Minister for Workplace Relations and Safety. Was he advised by officials that agriculture was in the highest risk category and dairy cattle farming in the second highest when determining which industries should have health and safety representatives? If so, why did he remove them from the list?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Dr. Nick Smith.
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, no. The highest risk category was coal mining at 322 fatalities per 100,000 employees. The second highest was forestry at 77, fishing and hunting at 35. Agriculture was at 12 per 100,000 workers. It is also a bit arbitrary as to where you draw the line between risk categories, and that is why the government is currently consulting on the draft regulations.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
Point of order, Ian Lees-Galloway.
This was a question on notice, sir, and the question asked order. If he was advised by officials that agriculture was in the highest order. Risk category. He has not addressed that question.
I agree entirely with the member. The best way forward is I will allow the member two additional supplementaries. Supplementary question, Ian Lees-Galloway. Order.
I can't say that about the Speaker.
If the Honourable Nick Smith wishes to stay to answer the best balance of the question, I suggest he stop criticising me. Ian Lees-Galloway. Supplementary question.
Was the Minister advised that agriculture was in the highest risk category by MB officials?
The Honourable Dr. Nick Smith.
No. The advice from the department that I have received and have before me is that the highest risk category was coal mining. The second highest risk category was forestry. The third highest risk category was fishing and hunting. Agriculture was the eighth highest.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
Point of order, Ian Lees.
I seek leave to table the advice given to the Minister that demonstrates that agriculture is in the highest risk category.
On this particular occasion, I will put that leave. Leave is sought to table that particular document. Is there any objection? There is not. It can be tabled. Point of order, the Honourable Dr. Nick Smith.
Mr. Speaker, I seek leave of the House to table the advice that was received by the Minister on the categories and the risk ratings applied it to them by
Fidelity. Can I just clarify, is that not the information we've just had tabled by...
No, it's very different
no
to the representations.
No point in tabling it twice.
Well, I think that's the issue, Mr. Speaker.
Then I will allow, I'll put the leave as well, and then the members will have all the information they need to sort it out for themselves. Leave is taught to table the particular documentation presented by the Honourable Minister. Is there any objection? There is none. It can be tabled. Supplementary
question, Mr. Speaker.
Ian Lees-Galloway.
When his office emailed the principal policy advisor at Moby outlining his own criteria for determining high-risk industries, was he aware that he was setting the criteria at exactly the right level to exclude dairy farming?
The Honourable Dr.
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, I cannot state what the Minister was aware or not of, and I apologise for the member. If he wished to put it in writing to the Minister when he was present, I'm sure he would respond.
Supplementary question, Ian Lees-Galloway.
Mr. Speaker, did he read the email from Moby dated 17 August 2015 that warned that his proposed regulations would define mini-golf, worm farming and being a TV anchor as high risk, but the entire construction industry as low risk? If so, why did he still release the list unamended 2 days later?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Dr. Nick Smith, either of those two supplementary questions?
On behalf of the Minister, I cannot comment on what exact details the Minister had read or not. What I would note is that the actual consultation risk categories that are currently out and have been published by the Minister, in my view, are a very sensible allocation of the level of risk and do not include any of the anomalies that the member has referred to.
And that's all for this week. I'm Tom Fruin, and this program was made with funding from Parliament.